Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
Boys, the war is over and Cap's gone and, oh my gosh, everybody's going home and packing up. So how horrible is this minute?
Well, the war in Europe is over.
Yes, that's true.
We still got VGA Day to wait for, but not too much longer. So minute 110, shall we?
Yes.
All right. In a dimly lit British pub, the surviving Howling Commandos, Falsworth, Dernier, Dugan, Gabe, and Jim raise their glasses, their faces somber. To the captain, Falsworth says, his voice steady as they toast to Steve Rogers. Aboard a Stark Industries vessel in the Arctic Sea, a technician calls out, "Sir?" A robotic submarine arm retrieves the glowing tesseract from the ocean floor, its blue light pulsing faintly. Howard Stark, peering over the technician's shoulder, responds, "Take us to the next grid point." "But there's no trace of wreckage," the technician says. "And the energy signature stops here." Howard's jaw tightens. "Just keep looking." Back at the Strategic Scientific Reserve headquarters in London, Colonel Phillips hands Peggy Carter a file labeled with Steve Rogers' name. She opens it, her fingers brushing over a photo of a short, skinny Steve at Camp Lehigh, his earnest face a stark contrast to the hero he became. Her expression softens, a mix of pride and loss.
Wow.
Such a mix of triumph and tragedy.
Yes, yeah. Indeed.
I have a big question about the Tesseract. This is all happening at the same time, right? I mean, we're not jumping back and forth across time. So it looks like shortly sometime in 1945, as they're winding up the war in Europe, good old Howard Stark is out there picking up the Tesseract. Mm-hmm. And as we will find out in later episodes, this kind of got paper-clipped. And Dr. Zola was winding up in the American camp. So what happens to the Tesseract between the end of World War II and present day? I mean, there's something that goes on.
We see it in Avengers Endgame.
Yeah, and we see it in Avengers.
When the Avengers do their time heist in Avengers Endgame, they go back in time to get the Tesseract in 1950-something?
Well, later than that, I think, because it's a...
Robert, oh, that's right.
Downey
It's the Jr.'s. 70s. Yeah. It's the 70s.
Yeah, see, it was the 70s because I'm picturing
That's right.
Sort of CRT Zola around that time.
Yeah. Back in time to the 70s. That's right.
Yeah.
Not right. When they go back in time and Steve sees Peggy's, that's not the 70s. Boy, now we got to rewatch that movie. Sorry.
Oh,
listeners.
Boy. Okay.
We're going to pause the podcast for just a minute. We've got about 35 MCU movies to watch real quick.
What we can do is, we'll just look at Endgame and we'll start the Endgame minute immediately ending this after the end of this podcast. We'll just go into Endgame.
The big picture relevant to your question is my assumption from what I gleaned from those future movies is that Howard has had Howard has had control of the Tesseract. From this point, he captures it here until for another, the next two or three decades.
Yeah, but he does nothing with it, as far as I can tell. I mean, I would think that Zola already knows how to make, tanks and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned it being paper-clipped. I kind of thought of it as being Ark of the Covenanted.
Okay, maybe that's it. Yeah.
Put it in the room for top men.
Yeah,
he got put it in over the safe and... These powers are not meant for humans to deal with.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll
know
we'll
it's
dig
somewhere.
It out when we're mature enough to handle it.
It's somewhere in Camp Lehigh, I would assume, but that's their their own little arc.
It's interesting the sophistication of the submersible and the robot arm, the mechanical arms and stuff. That's it still looks period, but it's not the sort of thing you're thinking of, them having in the 40s, but then again, we've seen Stark and then certainly Zola,
and it's
being
ahead
of their time.
Rather than being paper clipped, maybe those are skunk worked, that something going on out in the middle of the desert that they've been Howard's got his fingers in all kinds of things, and as we learned from Iron Man, the two movies ago, the Starks have been in the weapons business for quite a few years. So I'm just thinking somewhere he has like a submarine factory and God knows what else.
All right. While we've been talking, I've been Googling, and in Avengers Endgame, Captain America, Tony Stark, go back to Camp Lehigh in 1970, and that's where they encounter Howard Stark as the other actor, John Slattery, and it's also where they steal the Tesseract from.
So it is 1970. Okay. And
1970.
that makes sense.
And that's where Steve sees an older Peggy
Right.
and so forth.
So we're talking about a difference there of 25 years, and somewhere between it being arced and paperclipped. It's, I think it makes sense that, it's not like, hey, I've got the Tesseract now, free blue energy cars for everybody. We're just going to sort of spread it all over the place. I think it makes sense that it would be kept under wraps and they'd be very cautious about it. And even Zola, I don't, he figured out how to harness it, but does he really understand it? Could Zola explain like how it sort of ate the Red Skull and sent him off into the cosmos? Or I think it's just really beyond everybody's comprehension. I think we see some people being uncharacteristically cautious with it for a while.
Yeah, and it could be that, I mean, they're so siloed, all these need to know bases and ultra top
Right.
secret stuff. People might not know past Phillips and Agent Carter. And Agent Carter's dealing with other things at the time, as we see in her TV series. So
Yeah.
it might be, we don't have time for this right now. Put it in a box and we'll get back to it.
Right.
And
It
it just
raised an intriguing possibility that maybe only the Red Skull, with his mix of scientific genius and interest in the paranormal and the occult and the history of Norse mythology, maybe only the Red Skull had the proper mental attitude and tools and knowledge to really harness the thing. Everybody else is Zola's an engineer, as much as I love engineers and love the engineers in my life. Maybe they're not the most imaginative folks,
Yeah. Also, there could have been, I mean, pl the Danny Bilson told us plausible off-screen action is always acceptable. And maybe somewhere in the after the paper clipping of the Tesseract, maybe they did try some experiments and some of the technicians were turned into blue paste. So that might be,
Right.
let's put this up and think about it a little while longer.
Very much so. I agree. I agree.
Yeah, you're talking about very different ideologies in terms of testing and experimentation, and obviously, with Red Skull and Hydra being the Nazis of the Nazis, they're going to have no compunctions whatsoever about throwing bodies to test and try things and things. And hopefully, on our side of the world, we're a little bit more cautious and respectful than that. And Brian, your list of traits for the Red Skull, I thought was spot on, but it would certainly add hubris to the list.
Top of the list. Top of the
Definitely
list, yeah.
Just
a monkey's
that
paw level
cocktail
of
of,
whoops.
yeah, exactly.
All that arrogance of thinking he was suitable to be a god. If anybody on earth is suitable to be a god, by goodness, it's me. I had a thought about the irreconcilable Howard Starks, and it's something that I wish, if Marvel had had a plan at the start, I wish they'd handle it a little better. We see Dominic Cooper in this movie as young Howard Stark. And in future movies and so forth, we see John Slattery as older Howard Stark. Those two actors look nothing alike. I mean, Slattery, I
Right.
don't know how tall they are in real life. Slattery looks like he's a foot taller than Dominic Cooper.
He does.
Different body shape, different body
Maybe that
type.
was the
They
side effect of the Tesseract.
have different acting styles. I mean, they just
Oh.
don't look like the same character. And while I was rumbling this thought in my mind, I was informed again by the genius web that there's a third Howard Stark out there. There's an actor named Gerard Sanders who appears in a photograph in the first Iron Man movie as Howard Stark. So there are three Howard Starks
Oh,
in the
interesting.
MCU. But and then you get into this again, this 1970 era. Well, who should be playing that guy? Dominic Cooper or John Slattery? They went with Slattery. Fine, nice decision. But these just aren't the same. It's not the same character.
Yeah, and
Right.
his personality changed. I mean, John Slattery
Yeah.
usually plays John Slattery in every movie,
Yeah.
but Dominic
Yeah.
Cooper doesn't come across as that self-assured. Now you could say, well, maybe he became more self-assured as his plans worked out. But yeah, I agree that he just seems like to have an entirely different personality than the later characterization on it. But that could also be a function of scope creep in the MCU over the series. Like, well, we need him to be more of a John Slattery than a Dominic Cooper.
Although, it's, I mean, you make a good point about him being, not as self-assured, but on, but you see flashes of that in the film. I mean, the whole, late night fondue invitation is, that's not the act of somebody who's so timid and shy, especially compared to, compared to Steve. And he's certainly willing to, in this minute in itself, he's on the bridge of this his vessel, and he's not shy about giving orders and pushing, let's continue the search and things. But he doesn't have that complete easy, sort of I own the room, sort of charisma that that we see from Slattery.
Well,
It's
I
like I
might
look at
favor
Dominic.
just
Oh, see what I say.
I was thinking that maybe I think they cast him in relationship to Robert Downey Jr. because he has more of the Robert Downey Jr. when he's with the girls,
He
and he's
does,
showing the levitation thing. So maybe they were thinking that, but didn't picture Slattery later on.
Well, Dominic Cooper just seems like a young Howard Hughes to me, which is obviously the archetype. John Slattery seems to me like the CEO of IBM, whoever the heck that was in the 60s and 70s, and
Exactly.
it's just like, how did this swashbuckling guy who's flying planes over the Alps in enemy gunfire, how did he become this button down stick in the mud? Just I don't like that arc. I don't
Although
see
it's
it.
interesting, like at the when we see the flashback footage of the Stark Expo, is that the beginning of Iron Man 2? Where we're at the modern day expo and we see the flashback. I mean, obviously he's 150% Walt Disney with the diorama of the city of tomorrow and all that kind of stuff. And I could just, I mean, we all could just sit and watch hours and hours and hours of just that, not going anywhere. I just eat that stuff up. But
Well, you're very right. I forgot about that scene in that movie, but yeah, John Slattery plays a great Walt Disney-ish, and maybe that's the arc of this character is Howard Hughes to Walt Disney to button down CEO. Maybe that makes sense now.
Yeah, maybe if you have that stop at Walt Disney sort of in the middle.
That's my
Although,
new headcanon.
all right.
Yeah, but
Well,
where's
looking at
Obadiah Stane in all this? That's what Obadiah was in the original Iron Man. I'm just wondering, is that the technician that's next to him? Is that one of the other techs that's standing around? Because, but he wasn't an engineer though, if I remember correctly, he was getting the information from Stark's other guys that were in the lab.
I always thought Obadiah was, Stark was the brilliant engineer and entrepreneur, and Obadiah was the business guy. But I got the sense like Obadiah was the Steve Ballmer to Tony's kind of Bill Gates,
Okay,
before
yeah.
before the Epstein
That
stuff
makes
and
sense.
whatever.
Yeah, okay. Wozniak versus Jobs. So, yeah, no, understood. Somebody, he's like the level-headed guy to figure out how to make money, and the other guy was the showman and also
Yes, the
the
showman
smarts
and the
behind it.
thinker, the brainstormer is gonna have these flashes of brilliance and things. And
Cool.
it's funny too, like I look at Dominic Cooper in this as we're talking about him, and it's like he's like a short Clark Gable. And
Yes, very
he could
much.
have
but so
was Howard Hughes,
but
you know,
so
if you,
so yeah,
yeah.
exactly. So was Howard Hughes, that little thin mustache and things.
Yeah,
So
I would like to bring up the music in this. Well, it comes in from the previous minute, and this whole idea that's coming across here that Silvestri is using. We hear these beautiful. It's very subtle in this particular minute, but it's this song has been going on. This little motif has been going on since the flying wing was heading for the ocean, and he was talking with Peggy. Then it comes up in the middle, that middle minute, this past minute, where we get this these major tones with the VE celebration, and then it goes back down into these minors. And let me just get a little bit of music theory here. I wish Tom were still on the show for this one, but there's a repeated use of the fourth and the fifth, and it which is typical in like a lot of hymns and things. And it's kind of to the audience, it's the sound of war memorials And there's so many, like, there's these minor, these modal shifts to show loss and solemnity. And then it goes into these rising lines where there's a chorale-like writing that it feels like it's like you're at a funeral service. And then the percussion, the brass come up for duty and heroism. And this thing of an open fourth and an open fifth, I don't have my guitar with me or my organ music, but it's F, C, G, E flat. And it repeats back and forth across this. And this is what we associate with just about every hymn that you've ever heard played at a memorial service. But it's also in just about every war movie you've ever seen. If you listen to Thomas Wander and Harold Closer did the end theme to Midway, the latest Midway movie, you'll hear it in there. Probably everybody knows the Hymn to the Fallen that John Williams did. That's at the end of Saving Private Ryan. You can also hear this in Band of Brothers, what's known as the Second Suite. John Newton Howard, if you ever listen to the theme music to From the Earth to the Moon, it has it in there. Particularly, there's a song called Earth Rise from the 1968 episode where Apollo 8 is seeing the Earth rise above the moon. You'll suddenly hear all these fourths and fifths. I guess the other one is Mark Isham's From October Sky, the song This One's Gonna Go for Miles, which is the end scene of that where Chris Cooper is with Jake Gyllenhaal and they're watching the last rocket go up. It's all these fourths and fifths. They're all pretty much, if you could play them back to back, and I can't hear because of copyright, but if you play them back to back, you'll go, oh yeah, there's the one note in the big Jurassic okay. Park has it. When you first see the Brontosaurus is walking through the forest, those are fourths and fifths. So
and that whole 1-4-5 progression minus that, you know, going from the F to the E flat, but that 1-4-5. And when people talk about three chord rock, that's what they're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
We're very used to those chords going together. We hear this one, then we hear that one, then we go back to C, and then we go up to G, and then back to F, and then back to C. And that whole thing's a very familiar progression. And so when at whatever point we're introducing like something like going to that E flat, just going down that step, that changes the tone. To me, like that makes things more, it makes it more serious. It adds a little bit more gravity, and you're taking away my happy, very tight, sort of quaint little resolution.
Yeah. And it's very pensive. Like in the beginning part, this first 30 seconds, it's 1-4-1 and just keeps going back. So but you really feel it, especially when you're thinking about the types of instruments that they're using. You're hearing the pizzicato strings and the harp that are at the beginning there. And then they add in at the end, the oboe, which is one of the most plaintive instruments in any orchestra. I mean, you hear that in Princess Leia's theme, and you feel it. It's in the same register as the human voice, so you feel it's almost like a cry. But it's,
I was
so,
about to so say effective. That to talk about the instrumentation too. I mean, I hear some cello in there, some viola, and these are just like, these are the sounds of mourning, you know, the instruments of mourning, just that deep, the deep strings. And then, but there's also, there's some brass in this minute too, associated with victory and a little uplift too.
Well,
this minute has a really interesting arc of emotion expressed through the music.
And it has multiple arcs, like something I hadn't really noticed until scrubbing back and forth here a bit. And I don't want to wander too far because the music behind this plays a big part of it too. But when we see the toast, you know, we go from the jubilation outside, you know, it's bright colors, everybody's cheering, hooray, you know, this part of the war is over. Then we go inside and we're right up close, we're almost uncomfortably close to the commandos for their toast. Mm-hmm. And this is a bit more somber, this is more serious.
It's brown and gray.
It's brown and gray.
And they're already in their civvies. Some of them are in their civvies.
Almost all except for, Falsworth.
Yeah.
Almost said Falstaff. So we're very intimate with them. It's like we're participating in the toast. Now we're backing away. Like we're backing away from this somber tone. And as we back away, couples are coming in front of the camera. Like we've made room for them. They're hugging and smiling and embracing. So that's another. Yeah.
That's
whole
a great shot.
Shot is another path from, boy, we, you know, we lost him, but we won everything else. And, you know, that back and forth and back and forth. And then suddenly we're ice cold back under the water. And, you know, everything's blue and and all that again. And we're just changing palettes left and right.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much is packed into this 1 minute, and that, you know, the beauty of it all is that you're not noticing it while you're seeing it on the screen. You're not noticing all the mechanics of it. You're just feeling,
but you're feeling it.
Yeah.
I noted that same shot you did too, Hal, of the Howling Commander's close tight. Yeah. And then you pull back to, they're not celebrating. They're having a solemn toast to the captain, but then it pulls back and they're surrounded by celebration. And it made me think, it established a context that it made me think about the real war, which is that these survivors knew dozens and dozens of people who'd given their lives to win the war. And Captain America was just one of them. Captain America is our main character because it's the movie's named after him. He's the one we care about. But these guys knew 100 Captain Americas. They didn't know Captain America's superpowers, but they knew good men who'd given their lives to win this war. And it's really neat. It really grounds this minute and this movie for me into what the real point of the war, what the sacrifices of the war really were.
Yeah. And it's like, there's these little clutches of people in this bar. They're having, they're having completely different reactions to what's going on.
Yeah.
Right. But you think about that as we've discussed before, that this, you know, except for the Axis, you know, the whole world is feeling that same way. You know, thank God it's over and hooray, we won, the good guys won, but oh my God, the cost, but it's over, we won. It's just that, you know, back and forth, like an entire population having those on those same, that same emotional roller coaster for some period of time.
Yeah. And they all had to put, I mean, Cap for all of their intents is dead. He's never coming back. And in a way that's true for all of them there. They'll never see him again. And what happens next? Where do they go from here? What's the world like without a Captain America? And, I mean, we'll find that out in future episodes of what, you know, the in between parts were, but, what's up next for Peggy? How does that go for her?
Well, seeing the Howling Commandos giving this toast put me in mind of the St. Crispin's Day speech from Henry V, Shakespeare's Henry V. You know, the Howling Commandos are going to go on with their lives. They're going to go back to their homes, and they might have, some of them might have families, and they'll be telling the stories about Captain America and Steve Rogers for the next 50 years. And people who hear those stories will envy them that they were there and be sorry that they, the listeners, were not there. The St. Crispin's Day speech is just one of the great pieces of heroic poetry and literature in English language. And Captain America, the First Avenger, is not Shakespeare, but that sense of loss and pride, and you will tell your grandchildren about this day, is very strong in this minute for me.
For true. And one little bit of minutia that I didn't realize until I was, you know, step framing through it is under his, the list for Steve Rogers at the bottom of the page, it says next of kin, none. He has none anywhere. Like there's no family at all. I mean, it's, his father got gassed and his mother died. Picked up tuberculosis working as a nurse and couldn't shake it. So he's got nobody in his family, nobody to remember him by. There won't even be a cenotaph for him because he just didn't exist.
Although there will be an exhibition at the Smithsonian.
That's true. Yes,
indeed. Wouldn't you just love to see the rest of that form? I want to see what address they put in there. Yeah, you know, 14047 BR or something, you know.
Yeah,
Bryant assuming, Park, who knows?
Yeah. But Avenue B. It's probably, usually when they do New York addresses, they give it a high or a low, or they give it a very high number. So if you ever tried to find the place, it was either in the middle of the East River or the Hudson.
Right. You just go off the island and into the water.
It's right there at, you know, 999 East 32nd Street. Wow. But, a great minute. Yeah. And, Wow. Well, we've got a couple more minutes to go. But if you enjoyed this particular minute as we did, we'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to continue that conversation, we're always available over at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. We've only got a few more minutes to go, so please check in. But be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.